Alex, in fact, told me that this talk should be about holographic complexity. That's the title, but also I'd like to perhaps cover new material since I think a lot of you have seen my collaborators lecture on this material before. First, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. It'll mostly be about holographic complexity. That's joint work with Adam Brown, Brian Swingle, Lenny Susskin, and Ying Zhao. Ying is here and is actually quite the expert on this material, so I would advise you to direct all your questions towards her if you can. I should probably address one other thing since Mark was laughing about before, I think, I was trying to explain to my parents after I graduated why I had to travel to conferences this summer and give talks, and they couldn't understand because, you know, I guess I'm technically unemployed right now, and, you know, they said I graduated and, you know, how could I have work to do still for MIT, and I was also confused about where I was located, so I didn't know what to put, so I just put my home address here. The reason I bring this up is that my parents asked me what this conference was about, and I said, well, I can tell you and probably summarize it, so I can summarize it in just one slide. There's some sort of black hole, and I guess this is a hard drive, and I guess actually this is probably what the summary would look like in 1975. That with Bekenstein and Hawking, that equation has been around for a lot longer. That's the short equation for the Schwarzschild radius. In 1975, we find out that black holes are thermodynamic systems. They have entropy, it's proportional to the area. And if you think about what entropy means carefully, I guess like about half of the audience here does, then you know that entropy is related to some sort of information storage capacity, and we can think of black holes as nature's densest hard drives. I guess moving forward in time, in 1997, the conference might have looked something like this. Another funny story, I guess I'm mostly just gonna tell you stories and summarize things, but I spent an hour trying to figure out what picture I should put here on the right side of the screen to represent conformal field theory. Then I realized that the whole point of ADS-CFT is that the best picture, the best geometric representation of some strongly coupled, strongly interacting theory is in fact the ADS representation of it. So this is what you got here. The conference summary now might look something like this. Is Daniel Harlow here? Before he objects even not being here, this is not supposed to represent any sort of computer. This is just supposed to represent information theory. And so we have relationship between black holes and high energy physics and information theory, and you know, it from qubit is what this conference is about, and there's some sort of geometric quantities that we relate to information theoretic quantities like entanglement entropy, or try to use those to derive facts about the geometry, and that's what a bunch of other talks were about. In this talk, I'd like to try and introduce another quantity, computational complexity, and talk about how we might think about that being represented in the bulk in the ADS side of the ADS-CFT duality. The main sort of state that I'm going to study is known as the thermofield double state. Here, let me just explain this picture for those of you who are not familiar. This is an eternal black hole in ADS. Represents a black hole that doesn't evaporate. There are two asymptotic regions, one on the left and one on the right, and they have boundaries at a radius of infinity, and then here there's a singularity at a radius of zero. If we consider the state when both CFTs are at the middle here at time zero, this is known as the thermofield double state. In using the holographic duality, this is an entangled state of two CFTs, one that lives on the left boundary and one that lives on the right boundary. They're entangled and they don't interact. And the sort of things that I want to consider in this talk are, starting with the thermofield double state, I can time evolve using the boundary CFT Hamiltonians on the left and the right, so I can change, I can use the Hamiltonian to evolve them in time, and that gives me some other state that I've written here, parameterized by the two times, and I want to try and understand how the complexity of the CFT state changes as I evolve in time, and whether there's some geometric way of representing that in ADS, and also how to compute it. Good. So the question I'm asking really is, what clock ticks for the longest time in ADS? So to address that, I should just first say what sort of quantities can be clocks. Clocks usually correlate with some passage of time. If you have a watch on your wrist every second, it ticks for an additional second. So it's some sort of quantity that changes linearly with time. It's proportional to the flow of time. So we're looking for quantities that are basically linear in time and that continue to correlate with time for a long time. Okay. So, oh, and I should add that one of the nice things about having lots of collaborators who give lots of talks about this material, this is actually the first talk I've given on this material, is that they've all created lots of slides on themselves, and some of them are very pretty, and so you can ask them, and oftentimes they agree to let you borrow their slides. So a lot of these slides, in fact, the prettier ones, were made by Adam Brown, so I should just give him credit for that, in particular this one. However, his talk had some very beautiful transitions, and I cut all those out, so he probably will be upset if he actually ever watches this talk, but in any event, so I explained this is an eternal black hole in ADS. So now we have boundary here on the left side at r equals infinity. We have another boundary at we have the singularity at r equals zero. And so what I want to do is I want to consider a bunch of spatial slices that we can take and try and what we're going to do first is just look at a bunch of spatial slices through this geometry. So the first slice we can do is a slice going from r equals infinity to r equals zero. And so this is a representation of that slice. The radius out here is infinite. It's cut off, but it's supposed to be infinite. And then the radius decreases until it pinches off at the singularity at zero. Another thing we can do is we can take a slice from one boundary to the other. So here, one r infinity on the left side, here's another r equals infinity on the right side, and we've taken a slice, this t equals zero slice that represents the thermofield double state, and we have the picture, it looks like this. This object is often called a wormhole. This part here, the part that goes through the middle of the black hole, it's often called a wormhole or an Einstein-Rosen bridge, and the throat here has a radius roughly of the black hole horizon radius, or the Schwarzschild radius, within an order one factor. So now, as I mentioned a couple slides ago, the sorts of operations we can, or the sorts of simple operations we can do here is evolve the boundaries in time. So one of the things we can do, okay, good. So in my conventions, time moves up on both sides, so there's a left time and a right time, and as I said, the state is composed of two non-interacting CFTs. They have separate Hamiltonians, so I can choose to evolve with one, or I can choose to evolve with the other. And so one of the things we can do is we can evolve with the left one up and evolve the right one down for equal amounts of time, and that didn't, despite moving the surface, the slice we're taking, it didn't change anything about the geometry of the surface. There's a symmetry here that if we evolve up on one side or down on the other, or vice versa, there's a boost symmetry and the geometry doesn't change at all. However, I can choose to evolve both the times up on both sides, and I find something very curious that we take a slice that looks like this, and we find that the wormhole length increases roughly linear in the two times that I've evolved with the time on the left and the time on the right. And in fact, in the classical gravity calculation, if you do a computation that gives you some sort of representation of the slice, you'll find that this just increases linearly in time forever. I'm being sort of vague here, but that's you can think of it like that if you'd like. Let's call it the maximum volume slice. You can also, in this simple case, you can take, for instance, a codimension 2 surface will do this and live at a different radius, but then you don't get the whole. No, let's just call it a codimension maximum volume slice. That's fine. Okay. Good. So we found some sort of geometric thing in ADS that is linear, that grows linearly in time, appears to grow linearly in time forever. It's a nice potential representative of being a clock. So we can ask another question, since we have this ADS-CFT duality, what clock ticks for the longest time in a holographic CFT? Based on CFT results of Cardi and Calabrese, Hartman and Maldacena studied this in holography, and so you might have wondered whether entanglement entropy would provide a nice clock like this. So we can do the same sort of thing where we start with a thermofield double state and we evolve for some time t. And here I've, in a slightly different type of picture, drawn the same spatial slice along this blue slice here. And I want to compute the entanglement entropy in some subregion. Sorry, that should say L. So in some subregion. And what you find is that at early times, for times that are less than, I think it actually should be L over 2, but or it should be just order L, let's say. So for small enough times, the entanglement entropy will grow linearly in time. It's computed by this red HRT surface here. And then however, there's a competing HRT surface, which is this blue one that I've drawn here, the ones that are disconnected on both sides. And so after some time t, there will be a transition where this one will be the minimum one instead of this one. And so this clock will saturate at a time of order L. So entanglement entropy makes a clock for a short amount of time, but does not make a very long clock. Just let me reemphasize this wormhole length. This red geodesic, for instance, or this red codimension 2 surface, this red HRT surface, also continues to increase in time for an arbitrary amount of time. The problem here is just that there's another competing surface that computes the entanglement entropy, and so as a result, this clock maxes out at some early time based on the size of the region that you're considering. Okay. So again, what clock ticks for the longest time in a CFT? Sorry about that. So the claim that I'd like to make and argue for is that it's related to the computational complexity of the underlying CFT state, computational gate complexity. Let me give you a few facts about computational complexity and then explain why this is a candidate to be a very long clock. So first, the sort of state that I have in mind is, say, the time evolution of the thermofield double state that I've been talking about. What is the definition of computational complexity? Starting in some kind of reference state, which, for instance, we'll usually take to be the thermofield double state, how many fundamental gates, for instance, you can consider a unitary that only acts on two qubits at a time, are needed to make the state of interest to within some sort of accuracy, for instance, within some sort of accuracy, epsilon. And so couple effects. The computational complexity of the thermal field double state by this definition is zero. You can argue sort of very, you can argue that the maximal complexity of most of the states in the Hilbert space is exponential in the number of qubits. So if we have n qubits, most states will have a complexity of roughly 2 to the n. And then another fact is that for the complexity of time evolution, complexity is expected to grow linearly in time until it saturates at an exponential amount, at an exponential value. So for these reasons, this has a good, this is a good candidate to be a clock. It grows linearly in time, and it grows for about as long as you could possibly expect it to. For instance, at least just for some intuition here, at least just classically, if I have n bits, I can represent numbers up to 2 to the n. So the largest clock I can build with n bits is something that's exponential in the number of bits that I have. And so this is for a system with a finite amount of entropy, finite number of qubits, we might expect this to be the best sort of clock that we can make. So let me motivate this bottom part, that this computational complexity of time evolution should grow linearly in time. So here I have some sort of time evolution operator. And so I want to think about discretizing it to a set of two-body operators. So if my Hamiltonian has some sort of locality to it, or some sort of, it doesn't even need to be locality, it just needs to be a sum of operators of low weight. This is often called k-locality. So let's assume that it has let's assume that it's just a sum of two-body operators in this case. Then what we can do is we can take each of those terms in the Hamiltonian and take their exponential for some small times minus I for some small amount of time delta, and that specifies some gate, and so we can think about a process by which we implement our unitary operator U of t by some sort of discretization procedure of applying a set of simple gates that look like this that I'll just draw as an X. This is often known as trotterization and can be useful in a bunch of different contexts in actually implementing or simulating things like time evolution. But I just want to argue that if we start and we assume that that the complexity of an individual gate is order one, so it's very simple to make these sets of gates and we can arrange them, then time evolution should roughly grow linearly in time. So if we start here, with the identity, so we evolve for no time, and so we have some time is going to flow down now, and we have some collection of qubits. And so every time step, I apply a set of these gates in a following alternating fashion in order to implement this time evolution. And we can see just by construction, this is going to grow linearly with time. We apply roughly n or n over 2 gates per time step, and every time and then every time step we apply another set of gates. So complexity of time evolution with some sort of Hamiltonian that has some sort of nice structure like this will grow linearly in time. So now that we've found two things that grow linearly, yeah. In factor where?
Well, if you go back and that's order one, but doesn't it have a number of gates, which is, if we're counting gates, doesn't have a number of gates, which is...
Yeah, I think I meant that just to be this individual tensor. I just meant that, I want to say that the complexity of making one of these small two-body gates is one. And so then, yeah, every time step, there will be a factor related to the entropy times a factor related to the number of such time steps, right? So the overall complexity will have a factor of n. So, That's your question. Okay. Yeah, this is just the complexity of a gate. So if we, or another saying another way, I'm choosing to measure my complexity in terms of fundamental gates, which I'm constructing like this. Okay. So the argument here is that, or the claim here is that we found two quantities. Both of them grow linearly in time, and both can. So the complexity. Sorry. Let me take a step back. So we found some quantity in ADS that grows for a very long time, and we're looking for some quantity in the CFT that also grows for a really long time. One candidate for that is computational complexity. Both of these quantities act as clocks. They grow linearly with time. And the complexity can be exponentially large in the size of the system. Classically, in gravity, the wormhole length, the calculation that showed that the wormhole keeps increasing as we increase time, suggests that will go on forever. However, for a variety of reasons, we expect the classical gravity picture not to make sense at a time that's exponential in the entropy. For instance, that's a time where we might expect the 1 over n expansion to break down and non-perturbative effects to become important. So we can think of both of these. Both of these can be exponentially large and roughly max out at the same time. So that's all very nice, but that just says that there are two things that are clocks. It doesn't tell you that they're related. We should generate some additional evidence to find out that they're related. And to do that, we need to bring in one other fact about complexity that I failed to mention before. So that's that complexity means minimal. So the computational complexity of a circuit isn't just the way you chose to make the circuit. So if I am preparing some state, or I'm preparing some circuit, and I lay down a bunch of gates, and I keep a track of the number of gates that I'm laying down, and I find out that I laid down a certain number of gates, that's not equal to the complexity of that's not necessarily equal to the complexity of the state that I've created, because there might be a faster way of doing it. There might be a better way of doing it. What is meant by complexity is the minimal circuit that generates the state or operator in question. And so to illustrate that here, I've drawn the circuit for this operator W of T here. W of T is the Heisenberg time-evolved operator of some simple operator W. Or said another way, W of T is the operator I get by evolving back in time, let's say, for time. Oh, there's, I'm missing I's here, I apologize. Back in time for time T, let's say, and then the application of the operator W, and then I evolve forward in time for back for time T. And so that's this operator W of T, and there's some circuit that builds this operator. And the other point I should make is that I'm thinking of W as being some operator that's localized in space. So for instance, if this is the circuit for time evolution, this might just be some other random gate that I have lying around that I threw into the circuit. So I evolve for some time, and then I accidentally throw in some random gate, and then I evolve back in time. And the question is, what does that circuit look like? So first of all, if this operator wasn't here, if this W wasn't here, even though I have this long circuit that has lots of gates, then the time evolution on this side will cancel with the time evolution on this side, and the overall complexity should be zero. If I evolve forward in time and then I evolve back in time so that I've done nothing, the minimal way of doing that is to just do nothing. However, if I act with this operator here, if I throw in this random gate, that will change. That will prevent the cancellation in some places, and so we still have some non-trivial operator. However, if we're thinking about something that's relativistic due to causality, or if we're thinking about a non-relativistic system, there's bounds on how fast information can propagate and how fast the influence of this operator can be known. We don't expect somewhere up here to know that I've added this sort of devious gate down into the circuit over here, and so it should act just like there was nothing there and there should be cancellations. And so the minimal circuit for this sort of operator where W is a local operator and sort of the evolution is given by some sort of generic system will in general look like this. So we have the influence of this operator W will spread out linearly in time, and everywhere it reached, we don't get cancellations, and everywhere the influence didn't reach, we get cancellations. So we get a much smaller circuit. In fact, a small circuit with this particular sort of geometry. This you might almost call this a butterfly, in fact, and it's sort of curious because the pattern of cancellation is very much related to chaos. So you get this sort of nice pattern, and you should expect similar sorts of patterns if you act with multiple operators. You should always are interested in finding the minimal circuit. So given that a requirement of complexity is that the circuit be minimal, we should ask, does the same thing happen in ADS? That is, if I evolve for some time in ADS, in this eternal black hole geometry, and I start acting with operators, and then I evolve back in time, do I get a wormhole length, or Einstein-Rosen bridge length, or geometry that represents these cancellations, or does it just continue to grow? And that would be a first test of the sort of relationship between holography and complexity. So to test this, we need to invoke some of the work of Shanker and Stanford, which is about black holes and chaos. And we only need a small part of their work. And that's basically what I just said, summarize and go in a couple of sentences. So we start here with the thermofield double state. And what I want to do is I want to evolve, say, on the right boundary for some time t. So I've now moved up for some time t on the right boundary, and then I'm going to act with some operator w, and then I'm going to evolve back to time 0, time tr equals 0 on the right boundary. And what Shanker and Stanford pointed out was that this causes a non-trivial change in the geometry, or back reaction in the geometry, and so instead of the original Penrose diagram here, we get one with a different shape that has to be drawn with these angles, and there's what's called a shock wave running from where we inserted the operator down to the singularity over here. But the main point for this talk is that now the slice that we take through the geometry at this point, at the t equals 0 slice, is no longer the same as in the thermofield double state here. And in fact, it's going to be a lot longer. So somehow acting with this operator changed the geometry. And so what we should do is we should check whether we should check against our expectations of what the geometry looks like given that we acted with an operator like this. And what you find, in fact, is that the geometry takes exactly this shape. So if you act with some operator W that's localized at a particular point, like here, you find that the length, let's say, through the Einstein-Rosen bridge is proportional to t right where you acted with the operator, or 2t, I guess, and it decreases as you get further away from the operator, representing the fact that there's this cancellation. So in fact, even in these So you get a pattern of cancellations in the interior of the black hole. And so we can count that as additional evidence that in the CFT, when you act with some sort of operator on the boundary, you can think of that as due to chaos, we get some sort of increase in complexity. In the center of the black hole, we also get some sort of increase in size, and the two increases match it, including cancellations between the two sides, including the pattern of cancellations that you require for this to be considered as complexity. And it's not just in the simple case, you can act in these more complicated situations. You get some really long, complicated wormhole geometries, and you can probe these geometries using different sort of geometric observables, and you find that you get a pattern of cancellation regardless of how you acted with these operators, that exactly matches the geometry of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. So in some sense, you can think of this as an infinite parameter family of evidence. You can just keep acting with these operators at different times and different positions, and it will always match and make the pattern that you'd expect from the minimal circuit to build this state. So now I've been a little vague about what I've meant by size of wormhole to this point. That's why I was a little evasive, I guess, of your question before. But there are a bunch of different proposals out there of what we mean by size of wormhole. So I just want to take a few moments to go through them and argue for one in particular, although emphasize that this is more of a sort of understanding in progress, and that I'll explain the facts of these proposals and which reproduce all the evidence that I've given you so far. So let me just explain what the proposals are. So the first proposal you might have expected would be might have been length through the wormhole, take some sort of geodesic and follow it through the wormhole. But it turns out that doesn't work. The complexity you get by that does not match the complexity that you'd expect from the quantum circuit argument, and so you have to throw that out. So the next thing you might check is volume of the wormhole. And so this original proposal of Stanford and Susskind was that you anchored at two times, you find the maximal codimension one slice, the maximal volume slice, through the geometry, and that gives you the complexity. And since volume has units, you have to divide by Newton's constant and the ADS radius, which they chose arbitrarily, and they argue that the coefficient in front of the complexity is not meaningful, but what's important is the way that it changes in time, the way that it scales. Sometime later, in an effort to try and improve this conjecture, so this conjecture often goes by the name complexity equals volume, or CV, and it's the idea that the complexity is given by this maximal volume slice. Sometime later, with Adam Brown, Brian Swingle, Lenny Susskind, Ying Zhao, we tried to improve this so that we didn't have some sort of factor of proportionality here, so that it didn't involve picking a particular slice, and so that the factor of proportionality didn't change in different dimensions. And the thing we argue is that the on-shell action of the space-time region, which we call the Wheeler-DeWitt patch, which I've outlined here and I'll explain in a second, is equal to the complexity. So let me explain in a little more detail what I mean by this. So if you consider the boundary at two times and then take the union of all spatial slices from the boundary at that time, you get this diamond-shaped region called the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. And so we write down the space-time action in that region. We solve the equation, the classical equations of motion. We plug them back in to get the on-shell action. And our claim is that complexity is equal to action. And this also leads us to another conjecture. So in all the cases that we study, we always find that the rate of change of this action is less than or equal to 2 times the mass of the black hole. And so since we have an equality like this, this leads us to conjecture that what I meant is that black holes are the fastest complexifiers in nature. So that this is some sort of bound on the rate of complexity growth, and that somehow black holes, in addition to being the densest hard drives, also are the fastest at complexifying. So I just want to return, now that I've explained that a little better, to this question of volume versus action. So I think I actually said a bunch of these things as I was going, one reason to prefer action is because it's dimensionless. We don't have to introduce some sort of scale here. And that first fact leads one to wonder whether the coefficient of the rate of change might be meaningful. And so we find in any dimension that we always find that the rate of change for neutral black holes is 2m, independent of size and dimension. I should add that there's a conjecture of Seth Lloyd's, which is what motivated us to think about this as being meaningful, that the there's a bound on complexity coming from arguments from quantum mechanics, that the rate of change of complexity is less than 2m with, I guess, these factors of pi and h bar inserted. And so taking this logic to its conclusion, that suggests that black holes saturate this bound, and that we can derive meaning from this coefficient here. Veronica. So there's a couple of subtleties. In d equals 3, I think both the volume actually doesn't increase linear. Let me take a step back. What's that? Yes. Yes. The first point I wanted to make is that actually the volume I think increases quadratically at first instead of linearly, which might be a problem in and of itself. You're also right that in higher dimensions the Penrose diagram actually I guess we're drawing these correctly here. It's bowed in, and so this patch that I've drawn here at early times won't change for a time of order LADS. That's exactly right. In both of these cases, these effects persist for times that are small compared to, say, what you might expect the natural rate at which you can put down tensors are, or gates in your circuit. And so it's some sort of confusing fact about what it means to have some sort of fractional complexity or to have, If I have a gate set and each gate makes a large change to the circuit, and somehow evolving with a small amount of time is very close to the identity, and it's unclear how to interpret something that's not really changing the state very much. And one of the things that is we're trying to understand in the future is how to make sense of this early time evolution.
So the smallest unit is always the radius.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Often that's a time of order. You know, we think that if we take this tensor network ADS correspondence seriously, then these tensors live in some sort of bubble of size LADS again. So I'm pleading ignorance about what it means to be fraction of a tensor, at least at this point. Mark. Yeah, that's right.
Is there something like
that? Yeah, it's equivalence in the action picture.
So the density.
Yeah. You can. That's exactly right. You can consider the gradients of the action and probe basically The way you compute this has to do with the regions where the shock waves are and what their times and spatial positions are. In both cases, you get the same. You have to come up with some notion of like gradient of complexity or something to make it precise. But the feature of the geometry is the same, and that's what these pictures are supposed to emphasize, that it works the same way in both proposals. So it's not just, let me just say, Alex told me I'm supposed to repeat questions, and this picture is supposed to represent not just the fact that the adding up the total number of tensors is the same in both cases, which is what the complexity is. It's just one number. It's the sort of volume of the circuit, but also the fact that some sort of complexity gradient, the complexity along this line versus this line, or said another way, the whole geometry of this network is matched in the Einstein-Rosen bridge to the circuit that you'd expect. And really, I think the point is why do we have a bunch of proposals here? Why is there not just some answer? Is that we're not sure the best way. I guess what I would like to argue is that there's some sort of geometric fact about the black hole that is reproducing what you would expect for a minimal circuit complexity of a state. This volume is one way of doing it. This action is one way of doing it. There might be some other geometric fact that's even better that we haven't discovered yet, and that would be interesting to know. The idea is just to try and figure out what the sort of nicest, most invariant fact is, and I've given some arguments here for why one might prefer the action, someone else might have arguments for why one might prefer the volume, but for all the important tests they perform basically the same. Yeah.
So my understanding was that since the complexity is the number of minimum number of gates, the actual value you get depends on your choice of gate set. Mm-hmm. And but for different choices it's just like choosing different units, basically.
That's right. That's right. So I think there's, that's right. I think if this is to make any sense, there's some sort of implicit gate set choice here. You can also understand this by trying to figure out what happens if, I think there's some sort of implicit choice. If this is to make sense at all, some sort of implicit choice of gate set, I think the one that I find most compelling is based on the Hamiltonian, as I tried to illustrate when I illustrated time evolution, considering the terms of the Hamiltonian and exponentiating them for a small amount of time. That seems like a reasonable candidate gate set. A reason you might want to do that is that clearly, if you choose a gate set that's larger or has interacts with more qubits than just two, say, interacts with all the qubits, then the complexity can never grow very far at all, right? If you have n qubit system and you have n body gates and you have all the gates, then basically you just pick the gate that implements your circuit, and the complexity is always order one. So it seems to me like there should be some sort of natural choice made in terms of the system. There are some reasons why you might not want to do that too. Maybe that's a way of trying to nail down how to get this. The thing that's true is that this action change this appears to be some sort of GR fact about these geometries that this is always 2m regardless of the dimensions. And that's not true for the volume. The factor in front of the volume changes. So that suggests that this is interesting enough that perhaps there's a way of making sense of the constant, which is why we've tried to argue this, but yeah. Yeah, go ahead. So you do need to somehow cut off the integrals here and here at the boundaries, and we do involve to have a valid variational principle, we do have boundary terms in our action. In general, one might expect that the cutoff, the part that reaches out towards the boundary, is related to sort of the complexity of forming the thermofield double state from some trivial, say, product state. This picture that Brian Swingle has promoted and is now or first talked about of ADS being sort of like Mera. And so if you don't have a black hole, or the portion outside the black hole is some sort of hyperbolic network, and that has, if you take it out to if you don't cut it off, that has an infinite number of gates. And so somehow the part outside the black hole is related to forming something like the Thermofield double state. And in the part that I've mostly talked about in this talk is the part in the interior. And so that's why a lot of, you can just throw, you just subtract off the infinite piece as one normally does in field theory, or one argues that that's related to this complexity of formation, or one takes derivatives because that part should be roughly time independent and focus on what's happening in the interior. So. Yeah, there's a contribution. It's important to include the surface term along the singularity in order to get the 2m, in order to get the right answer. Okay. I don't see why not. I mean, everything stays finite there, and it's some sort of. You can think about it as this is some sort of effective field theory, and you can cut it off, at like a Planck length away or at something, and everything stays finite, and it's fine in this case. Okay. So that ends the organizer required part of the talk. Also, I should add that the reviewers in the journal, or the editor of the journal that we submitted this to, they actually wanted to change our title to be about a paragraph long, but they also required us to add a question mark, so now I've added that question mark here. But they did publish it. So there's a ton of further work. A lot of the questions you've all asked have highlighted that. Please work these things out. That would be great. In particular, these questions about what the action means and sort of the geometric properties are great. Please figure them out. Figure out what the right way of measuring these geometric facts are about ADS. That's the questions, what does action mean, basically. I can summarize that as, what is action? Those are the questions that I normally get when I give this talk. I actually expected perhaps to get some more questions from quantum information theorists. Perhaps I just lost them all the beginning, but their questions normally are, what do you mean by complexity, especially in theories where, like a CFT with a large number, that's a field theory and it involves continuously in time. So with the last 7 minutes, I'd like to try and address this particular question. And so this will be the by design part of the talk. This is now joint work with Benny Yoshida. It's only gonna be a very brief part of it, but hopefully I can sort of motivate why we might expect to make sense of complexity of something like a CFT or even just to start what it means for systems, a better definition of complexity, or how do we measure complexity for systems, sort of generic systems that evolve continuously in time. So what we're after is some sort of bound on complexity. And so first I want to introduce a counting argument that I understand is in the literature, although actually I don't know where Benny, where can I find this as well? Okay, so this is very elementary. So here's an elementary result, which is that how many circuits can we make with G gates acting on n qubits in delta steps? And let's assume that these G gates are universal for quantum computation, so I can make any, get arbitrarily close to any element of the unitary group by using these gates. And so there are G n choose 2 choices to make at each step, and therefore we can make at most, every time we lay down a gate, we have G n squared choices, and so there's G times n squared quantity to the delta number of circuits that we can make with this gate set in delta steps. So if we have a collection of different circuits we want to make, let me call that math cal E, I guess. I don't know how to say that out loud. Or is that a cap? I know it's math cal E, but is that capital epsilon, I guess? It just looks like E. I'm not sure of the best way of saying that. Maybe I'll just circle it when I want to talk about it. So if we have a collection of different circuits that we want to make, if we want to ensure that we can make all of them, then the minimal number of steps we require in order to make them, just by a, as Benny says, an elementary counting argument, relates the number in our ensemble to the number of steps and this factor here that is related to our gate set. So that means that if we have some sort of ensemble or collection of circuits that we want to make, we can somehow relate that to the complexity or to the number of steps, the number of gates that we require. Now I'm going to talk about something else that's slightly out in left field and then bring it back. So for any such ensemble, MathCal E, we can characterize how generic that ensemble is by using this quantity known as the frame potential. So if I have this set here, then I take a unweighted sum average of basically some sort of inner product to some power. And so this is this quantity, which I'm just defining here, is known as the frame potential or the kth frame potential. The reason I might care about this is that the frame potential is maximized if my ensemble is trivial, if it just contains, say, the identity, and it's minimized by the Haar ensemble. So the Haar ensemble is the natural measure on the unitary group. So if I have a random element of a random element of the unitary group and I want to do some sort of average, I want to consider all the elements of the unitary group, this is the right measure to think about. And so if I want to make all the circuits, what I mean is that I want to have a size that's of roughly the entire unitary group. So I want to match onto Haar. This should say that if for any ensemble that's defined by MathCal E, that for the kth frame potential it equals the Haar frame potential, that should not be less than, that should be equal, then that ensemble is a K design. And what that means is that it will reproduce K moments of the Haar ensemble. So if I have some sort of quantity that I want to average over all different unitaries using the Haar ensemble, if I can replace it with this other simpler ensemble if it's a K design and it only involves K moments. So finally, we can use this to first, we can see that if we require that U is equal to V dagger, we can get a bound on the frame potential, which lets us relate the value of the frame potential to the number of elements in our ensemble. So that's just by putting I here and doing the sum, and we see that there's some sort of relationship between the value that this frame potential takes and the number of elements in our ensemble. And so that means that we can, using our elementary counting argument, we can bound the complexity of the ensemble by measuring the frame potential. So we see that the complexity is lower bounded by this quantity that involves some sort of, that involves this constant factor here, minus the log of the frame potential, and then there's some factor here related to our choice of gate set. And so the final thing that I want to say is that for any ensemble of unitary operators, we can prove where B is given by this conjugation by the unitary that this out-of-time order correlation function, if you will, this where by out-of-time order I mean an alternating of A with B conjugated by unitaries in our ensemble, where we sum over all choices of operators in the ensemble, we sum over all choices of operators in the system and also do an average over the ensemble, that this quantity is equal to the frame potential. So what that means is that if we assume that we have some sort of generic Hamiltonian that we're evolving with, some sort of chaotic or generic Hamiltonian, then we can think of this as we can think of our system as, we can think of our ensemble as being the choice of Hamiltonians. And so a disorder average, or an average over these Hamiltonians of all these sorts of correlation functions, would be a way of measuring the frame potential. Based on the argument on the last slide, if we measure the frame potential, then we can place a lower bound on complexity. And in the particular case where there's some notion of self-averaging or some notion of where we have some sort of generic Hamiltonian, Like in holography, we might think that we can use a particular measurement in a particular system without actually doing the average as a way of lower bounding the complexity on that particular time evolution. And so our hope is that by using this and then trying to understand how this works in physical systems, we might be able to come up with a better way of understanding complexity in these physical systems, and we might have a better way of maybe understanding these proposals like complexity equals action, or perhaps even relating complexity and action by making use of some of quantities like these. Anyway, I think I'm out of time, and thank you. Yeah.
Like the null surfaces and the boundary and the singularity. Is there a reason in particular you're putting that term there? And also, could you comment on like the relative size of the boundary term versus the actual whole integral of the action?
Sorry, your first question is why do we have the boundary term in the action?
Yeah.
We're including it as one normally does to have a well-defined variational principle, and so it seemed natural to include. And I mean, you could break down the metric into components and you know look and see that there's second derivatives and so forth, and integrate it by parts, and you'll end up generating the Gibbons Hawking term naturally like that. But so. No, it means what it's the usual Gibbons Hawking term.
Is it imposed usually boundary conditions on the light surfaces?
I don't think the light like surfaces contribute.
Okay, that is singularity.
Yes, exactly. And then the second question was, was your second question?
Is it like, how big are those terms compared to the
boundary? The bulk term is negative, and the boundary term is positive.
And
they're roughly of order m, but with some order 1 factors, and they cancel to give you 2m.
Okay.
I mean, they mark.
Even in the charged black hole, you get?
No, in the charged black hole, you get something that's less. You can understand that because you have, you have these conserved quantities that you have to push around, so it doesn't complexify as fast. Go ahead.
Say more about from the CMT viewpoint, why the complexity wouldn't be getting growing linearly in time until, I guess you're thinking on a sphere that has a better radius, so until the light crosses the time of the sphere can grow linearly, or did I misunderstand that point?
Sorry, can you say that again? Until the, you're saying that the complexity shouldn't grow until the light crossing time, or you're?
Well, I thought that the volume and the action both did not start growing linearly in time until the ABS time passed.
Yeah, but the temperature is much, beta is much smaller than. Yeah. I mean, you might have wondered whether it's something like, you know, non-analytic, right? Like absolute value of t. But I plead ignorance about what it means to apply less than a gate, so I'm not sure.
I guess what I'm saying is, so the CFT is on a sphere with a definite radius.
Uh-huh. Well, the radius. I mean, I want to think about these as being roughly. We're talking about sort of things that are in the interior of the black hole. So the relevant scale is the is the thermal scale, right? And so there's many it's many I can think of that as many thermal cells, right? So yeah, that's right. Okay.
I also have a question about the upper bound for the rate of change of complexity. So, looking at different dimensions and different size of black hole, you've always got. And I thought you said that there's some bound that's similar to that.
Yeah. Yeah, the average energy. I think Seth might argue it is, but you can violate it by having superpositions in sort of a trivial way, and so there's some sort of caveat about not being allowed to do that. So, in the case of holography, that's fine because we don't modulo a paper that came out recently understand superpositions of geometries.